The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. We're very fortunate, again this month, to be talking about pediatric orthopedics, this month with our guest, Marcella Wojcik, who is back for more grilling this week. Welcome back, Marcella.
Thanks, Paul.
So this week, we want to talk about some functional orthopedic stuff. We've talked about shape a lot and dealing with feet and legs. Now we want to talk about what happens when a child comes limping into the office. Before we start, have you developed any conflicts or disclosures?
I have no disclosures.
All right. So, child comes into the office accompanied by a parent, and the concern is the child has developed a limp. Why don't we, it's hard to know exactly how to attack this, but why don't we start maybe by breaking this population down into ages? You want to help us with that?
Yeah, I think age is pretty critical in the conversation of why is somebody limping, because there's definitely different things that are more age specific and the diagnoses that we see for different groups. So when you and I were kind of preparing this, I was trying to think of who do I see with limping and what are the things that I lump into that? And I think the first patient that we see with limping is going to be the toddler. And then we see the child, which is going to be a little bit older, and then the adolescent. And I think the pathology in each of those age ranges is pretty variable. There are a couple of things that are consistent, but they also have different presentations. So in the toddler, I think limping can happen where you might have an associated fracture. And for many of us, we'll describe that as a toddler's fracture. But in general, like what I frequently hear is that the parent says they walked in the room, there was an unwitnessed event, and then all of a sudden their kid is limping. And then like the degree to which they limp, I think varies. But, you know, a toddler's fracture, which is a tibia bone break that you can't necessarily see on an x-ray, I think is very, very common. I do think that the parents and maybe even like the Instacare doc will say, well, maybe this is the foot or the ankle. I think the tibia bone is one of the most likely sources of a bone injury. And I feel like I can prove that pretty consistently in the sense that if I think somebody has a toddler's fracture and I put them in a cast pretty reliably a couple weeks out, they have really good new bone formation in their tibia. And so then I can successfully say to the parents, we've found the problem, we've treated it, even though we didn't know what it was in the beginning. But toddler's fractures are super common. I think infection is that other big category of things that causes limping in kids. And there's the kind of benign infectious process versus the more significant infectious process. So in littler kids, we can see transient synovitis. In my experience, we more often see transient synovitis in the hip or the knee. We can't see it in the foot, in the ankle, in the subtalar joint. We can see it in arms, but I definitely, you know, from a limping perspective, I'm going to see it probably coming from the hip or the knee. And transient synovitis, as you know, often will get better just with time and maybe some anti-inflammatories. And that would be your viral type of infection. So maybe the child had a viral illness before, they had a strep throat, they had an ear infection, they just had the cold or the flu, and then they had some irritability that caused them to limp.
One of the things about kids in general is they've usually had something recently.
Yeah. I mean, and it seems like if they're in any sort of daycare setting too, that probably happens like every day for most families. But then I think, you know, the more worrisome child is going to have a septic arthritis or osteomyelitis. And those kids, I think, look different than the transient synovitis kids. They look a little less well. They're a little bit more irritable. Maybe their limping is a little bit more pronounced. Maybe they have a fever. But I think, you know, broadly, like we see transient synovitis, septic arthritis, and osteomyelitis pretty commonly in toddlers and then again in children. Discitis, I think we were contemplating, I feel like that's pretty rare. Maybe you get a discitis once a year or twice a year, if that, but it's pretty unusual to get discitis that causes limping. It's definitely a thing to keep in the back of your mind, but that's more in the zebra category for me than the other typical diagnoses. And then
if I'm suspecting an osteomyelitis, what am I likely to see?
So in some parts of your body, you're going to have an adjacent septic arthritis. So you have to think about, you know, how irritable is the joint. I think osteomyelitis in and of itself may not have that much pain. It may have a subtle limp, especially more chronic cases of osteomyelitis. But acute osteomyelitis, you know, maybe you see some redness in the leg. Maybe you have a little bit of bone tenderness. If there is an associated like ankle septic arthritis, then you're probably going to see a big swollen ankle and something like that. But you'll have probably a pronounced limp. You'll have potentially some swelling and you may have a fever and you may have a child that just looks unwell to you. That looks like they're more sick than more of a viral pathology.
Very helpful.
I think there's one other thing to think about from a toddler's perspective. I think limping, every once in a while, I'll see somebody comes in that I might make the diagnosis of hemiplegia, where they're walking on their tiptoe and maybe they didn't notice that before. They're just starting to walk and their gait seems different, not necessarily a limp, but just like gait abnormality. And I, again, then would go back to like my birth history and inquire, like, did they reach milestones on time? Things like that.
There's sort of a continuum, isn't there, in all of these ages? And for one thing, I will go on the record as saying that if kids came with closed captions, we would be able to capture a lot more information in toddlers, because there are a lot of things that go unwitnessed. There's kind of a subtle difference between the acute limp, the subacute limp, and a chronic limp. And it seems to me that something, for instance, like a weakness or hemiplegia is going to manifest itself very slowly. What about a missed hip issue in a toddler?
Sure. So, I mean, probably the most common missed issue as a toddler would be a dislocated hip. And they might present a little bit kind of like this, the cerebral palsy hemiplegic patient that I mentioned. You know, they might present when they're walking up on a tiptoe. I mean, it's one leg shorter because the hip is dislocated. But also a lot of children that I meet that have had a dislocated hip on one or both sides have a somewhat benign exam. And maybe they have decreased abduction on their exam if you have one hip that's out and the other hip that's in. But if you have both hips that are out, you're going to have some decreased abduction on both sides, but that might be perceived as kind of normal for the child. We do see more of a waddling type gait if you have both hips dislocated. And I've seen that in kids who are 4 or 5 and they're maybe starting to go to school, and they might also have lumbar lordosis associated with that. But I don't think like our hip dysplasia kids technically limp. I feel like they just have a different gait as opposed to limping. And they don't really complain of any pain or irritability. They're really active kids.
And then, of course, the things that keep us up at night, the things like leukemia, what do I expect to see there?
Yeah, so I think, I don't know that I've picked up leukemia in a toddler. That might fall into more of the child category for me. But I think that that is going to present a little bit more consistent with like the septic arthritis or transient synovitis picture. And the places I've only found leukemia have been usually around the knee. I imagine some of my colleagues have seen that in other locations, but it's usually more knee related, I think. And for those kids, they might have a little bit of swelling, but it might just be a limp. And maybe they've decided to get some tests done where they're drawing some fluid out of the knee. And then it's like a negative aspiration where you're not seeing any bacteria. It doesn't seem viral. And in those kids, you'll want to get some advanced imaging studies or some other labs. So usually in the face of a limp like that, you know, if your differential is septic arthritis, transient synovitis, maybe leukemia, most of those kids are getting a CBC with differential, and you might pick up their leukemia on just some basic lab work. But that's on our list, but I think lower on the list of the things that cause limping for the kids that we see.
So then looking back, maybe at some overarching principles with this toddler group, from a history point of view, if you can get a history of an incident of some sort, that may be helpful.
Yeah.
Also then from a historical point of view, whether the child's been ill, whether it's fever, that sort of thing. Yeah. Anything else on the history that you're thinking about?
Some children who do have an associated septic arthritis might say that they had an injury beforehand. So I think temporarily they might say they fell off the trampoline or something and then their legs started to hurt. They don't always have antecedent trauma. So sometimes that's helpful, sometimes it's not. But I think the trauma part is still part of the conversation. Like, did anything happen?
Okay. And then the physical exam, What things do you think are most important? I think the number one most important thing is you should probably conduct a physical exam and maybe think more broadly than.
Yeah. So I think, you know, getting a history on kids and getting a physical exam are super important. And they're also, they can also be super frustrating yes. because they can't tell you. And some kids, when you ask them if they hurt certain places, they say yes everywhere. And then sometimes they say no everywhere. And you're trying to differentiate what that means. So, you know, if somebody has a hip issue, let's say it's infectious, whether it's viral or bacterial, they usually have irritability when you move the hip on their exam. So if you have them lying on your exam table, if you flex the hip up and you try to turn it in or out, it's probably irritating for the child. They're reporting some pain. If you have a really significant infection, probably more likely a septic arthritis at the hip, the leg is just going to rest in a flexed abducted position where it just kind of frogs out to the side. I think osteomyelitis at the hip, if it's just osteomyelitis and there's no septic arthritis, you may have a pretty benign exam. And that may be more for like a pelvic osteomyelitis. Like you may not see much. The hip might move comfortably, but you're going to have a limp despite that. Transient synovitis usually has some irritability. I think if you're talking about the knee or the lower leg, for a septic arthritis or an osteomyelitis that's around the knee, you're going to see an effusion or some swelling. You might see some redness. I don't feel like I see redness that often for infections. Maybe around the ankle I do, but not around the knee. And then they usually have pretty significant pain with range of motion of the knee. So if you have a really irritable looking hip, knee, or ankle, then I would start thinking, is this more infectious related? A toddler's fracture or like unwitnessed injury where we're thinking this could be a foot problem, an ankle problem, a tibia bone problem, I think they look really benign. Like they don't look sick. They don't really hurt when you move their hip, knee, ankle, or foot, but when you stand them up in front of furniture, they kind of limp along or they just choose not to want to walk and they go back to crawling. So those are the things that I'm trying to pick up on what they're doing with their exam. Discitis, if you have that infection, it's usually that the kid just doesn't want to walk more so than like a focal exam finding. And then like if this is more of a hip dysplasia issue, you're probably not going to have any pain when you move the hips, but you might have some asymmetry in your hip exam where one side is doing something different than the other, or you have a leg length difference.
Any guidance on x-rays?
I think it depends on what rabbit hole you're going down. I think if you anticipate that this is infection, then your probably next step, if you have the patient in your office, is they're going to the emergency room. And they're maybe going to get some labs, CBC with diff, sed rate, CRP. Maybe they get blood cultures if they look sick or a UA. And then they're going to get probably pelvis or knee x-rays there. A lot of times those imaging studies are negative. So even if you did them in the office, I don't know that you're going to appreciate an effusion because sometimes with kids that are small, they don't get a ton of swelling. But then, you know, like the next step.
You're kind of puffy by nature.
Yeah. Yes. And then, you know, the next step might be an ultrasound where we're ultrasounding the joint to see if there's fluid. Can we take some fluid off of the joint? And then more aggressively, you might step into the MRI category where a toddler is going to need to be sedated to look for more definitive pathology. Like, is this an osteomyelitis in addition to a septic arthritis? But if you think maybe this is hip pathology and it's like a dislocated hip, by all means, get an AP and a frog pelvis in your office or close by, and you could probably rule in or rule out a couple of things pretty quickly.
And if we can't find any answers, then that's always an occasion where we could talk to someone like you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And of course, as we've talked about on the podcast before, and we'd be remiss not to mention again, always a consideration about child abuse in a child who has a sudden change in wanting to walk.
Yeah, especially in a child who isn't walking, you know, where they're just starting to walk and then that circumstance changes. Like I'm more cognizant of non-accidental trauma in those kids.
All right, let's talk about the pre-adolescent group then.
In children who are, you know, maybe between the ages of 4 and 10, I think we will typically see transient synovitis, septic arthritis, and osteomyelitis as we did in the toddler. I think as most people on this podcast know that there's going to be different bacteria that might cause an infection based on age group. But still the same presenting history and physical findings would apply. In addition to infectious causes for a limp, the next thing that we see in this age group would be leg calf Perthes disease, which shortened we just describe as Perthes. And Perthes is AVN or avascular necrosis in a hip. It's usually one-sided, but it could be both sides. But it will often present with an intermittent painless limp in a kid that's, say, 5 years of age. We do see it a little bit more in boys. We think of it a little bit more in the hyperactive boy, but I don't know that I know many boys that aren't hyperactive. So I mean, that's kind of all comer boys. We can see it in girls. I do think Perthes happens a little bit older in some of my girl patients, but Perthes will give you that limp that just seems to, like, it comes, it goes. It seems to be more irritable when kids are maybe running or jumping. Maybe they hop off the trampoline and they look a little bit more irritable. So Perthes, you would potentially see some asymmetry in their exam. You might see them walking a little bit, where we describe it as Trendelenburg, where the hip and the leg are kind of shifting over. And then their exam is going to be pretty positive for some irritability with the hip. Those kids will need some long-term follow-up. So I think those are a really appropriate kid that needs a referral to a peds ortho person. And then beyond that, we can definitely see things missed hip dysplasia, missed like a hip dislocation, which results in a limp with limb length difference. I don't think that's as common in the United States as it might be in some other locations because we tend to pick it up. But I think Perthes and hip dysplasia, and then I think this is a little bit more rare, but you can see apophysitis that causes limping in kids in the 4 to 10 age group. And apophysitis is inflammation at some of your secondary growth plates. And if I were going to describe where I see limping from that, I'd say it's maybe more foot, like Sievers, which is calcaneal apophysitis. And I think that's more often in my 9 to 11 age group. But you also have growth plates in your elbows, at your knees, and those can cause some irritability with activity a little bit more than just at rest. But those, I think, are kind of the broad categories of things to be looking for in that age group.
I find it a little distressing how many places we have apophyses and how many of them can get annoyed.
Yes.
You want to comment just briefly on apophysitis? How long does apophysitis last?
Oh, I think it's kind of variable. We're back into the growing pains topic. I think that it depends on the location. So, and it also depends on what the kid's doing. You can see apophysitis in the elbow. And I see that a little bit more in kids who are throwers. So if I have a kid who's 7, 8, 9, 10, and he's pitching or throwing a ton, or she's like an avid softball player, then I think of apophysitis in the shoulder, or potentially in the elbow. You can get some growth plate irritability in gymnasts in their wrists because they're walking on their wrists a whole lot more than like I might have been when I was that age. But then like lower extremity apophysitis, you can see some apophyses that get inflamed around the hip. I don't think that's as common as like tibial tubercle issues like Osgood-Schlatter. But I think Osgood-Schlatter is a little bit more in my teenage population. I don't think I see that more in like the 9 or 10-year-old. And I see that a lot in jumpers. So kids who play basketball, kids who are playing volleyball and jumping up and down. And then the heel pain kids, the Sievers apophysitis, that's in your heel. And that I think is more my 9 to 11-year-old kid. But I think it's like the time frame that it lasts is variable. It could be a couple of months. It could be a year or two. I do think that Sievers burns out a little bit more reliably than Osgood-Schlatter. I have definitely met some adults who have like a really prominent bump on the front of their tibia from their Osgood-Schlatter that they tell me that they had for like 2 years and it took a long time to go away. So I think that's a little bit more variable.
Any particular history or physical points on these pre-adolescent patients?
I think for Perthes, you're going to probably see some asymmetry where one hip is doing something different than the other. That would probably apply for hip dysplasia as well. The apophysitis stuff is usually point tender. And I think those are a little bit easier to pick out than maybe even like a septic joint. And then also check like leg lengths, check alignment, and the other typical things that we mentioned back in our first and second episodes.
What do you think is the most reliable way to check leg length?
If I'm checking it clinically, I have the patient supine and I'll make sure they're flat and they're not like tilted on the table or something like that. And then I'll bend up their knees to look at their femur height. And then I'll put their feet on the table and I'll look at their tibial height. And I'll tell you that that's not the most accurate thing. It's not as accurate as an x-ray. And we have the ability to take a long-standing x-ray where we can look at you from like the low lumbar spine all the way down and making a measurement of the femur bone, the tibia bone. Maybe somebody had a club foot and their foot's a little bit smaller. That can contribute to a limb length difference. So having like the accuracy of that measurement can also be really helpful.
Okay. The good news in this group is that you are much more likely to be able to get some sort of history about trauma or about how long it's been hurting and how it's been hurting.
Correct.
Okay, let's go to the adolescents.
So for adolescents, I think, you know, infection becomes lower on my list. I feel like when I see infections of a septic hip or a septic knee, or maybe an ankle, it's my younger kids. They can still happen in adolescence. Again, they have different microbiology, but that's probably lower on my list. I think if you have somebody with a limp that's potentially painless or a change in how they're walking, maybe one foot's pointing out relative to the other, my first thing is to think about a skiffy, or it's maybe my first thing to rule out. So if somebody says their thigh hurts, their knee hurts, they don't always say their hip hurts, I'm getting a hip x-ray no matter what they're telling me. And whether that's in an obese patient or a skinny patient, doesn't matter. So I think about that. Adolescents will also start complaining of residual hip dysplasia. So whether somebody was treated for hip dysplasia as an infant or a toddler, or they were never diagnosed, they start to develop hip pain when they're 13, 14, 15. And so I think hip dysplasia is on my differential. And there's another condition that you can get in kids, which is kind of similar to Perthes, but we describe it as AVN, where it's avascular necrosis of a hip. And I see that more in boys than girls, but it happens and it seems to be happening with a greater frequency, but that will cause a limp. And then infection and then overuse type things are the most common things that I think we see in adolescents.
Do you find overuse injuries easy to treat in adolescents?
No.
nor do I.
No, I think kids, you know, the kids are really active and competitive, and they're way more than they were many years ago. And telling a kid that they're beating up their body a little bit and they have to take a break is, there's a fair number of tears and a lot of frustration. And it's a delicate conversation of trying to explain to a kid that they're an athlete, and sometimes athletes need breaks and you have to back off a little bit in order to get better.
Any particular insight into the history of physical exam in an adolescent? It becomes much more like an adult at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's different based on what your differential is. So the skiffy patient, more often than not, is going to be obese. They may or may not have some renal pathology or hypothyroidism. Maybe they have Down syndrome. Then I'm thinking skiffy. And so I think I would ask questions and do an exam and x-rays based on some of those findings. Hip dysplasia, as we maybe touched on a little bit earlier, I see it more in girls. So if they have a history of being the firstborn female, they were breech, there's a family history of hip pathology, then I'm thinking more in the realm of hip dysplasia.
And in this adolescent patient, have we just missed it the whole time?
Yeah. And it's not necessarily the worst thing. Like, they don't necessarily have the most severe pathology, but, you know, we, I think, do a really good job screening in the United States, but sometimes kids, like, they get an exam that's benign. Maybe they even had an ultrasound that was normal. They have hip dysplasia. And the treatment for hip dysplasia as an adolescent is definitely different than when you were an infant or a toddler. The chondrolysis history is a little bit more like Perthes, where maybe they had a painless limp and it gets a little bit more irritable. I do think their hip looks more irritable on the spectrum of like an infectious process, but the x-ray is the thing that's going to tell you what it is. And overuse, you know, I feel like those are hips, knees, ankles, and feet. I mean, that, like, the exam findings can be all over the place. And I think it just depends on what they're seeing you for.
And can sometimes be a little bit surprising, I think, in the way they show up.
Yeah. How much irritability they have, or, you know, if I'll even go to the point of getting an MRI, the amount of bone edema that you see for somebody who has overuse is pretty remarkable.
Interesting. All right. Well, this has been very, very helpful. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your expertise. For those of you who have questions, please send your questions to questions@vcurb.com. We'll deal with those next week. It's been delightful having you on here. This has been very, very helpful. Thanks to our listeners. Please like and subscribe, because, you know, that's how people find us. Thanks to Elisa Stoddard for making this all happen. And thanks, Janice, for listening. I'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.